this business about string theory, and my secondary goal for these lectures is to try to convince you that holographic duality is useful for doing physics, like physics involving experiments that you can do in like a laboratory on this planet with accelerators of finite size, or with equipment of size smaller than the galaxy, this kind of thing. But my primary goal is to try to provide enough information about this duality, enough of the context and background and some of the details about this duality for you to evaluate the truth of the statement and perhaps implement the truth of the statement yourself. So here's my plan, which I guess I should say is quite tentative and flexible, and I encourage your input in telling me what you want to know and in what I should do. So right, I guess you could say the title of my lectures is Holographic Duality and maybe some applications thereof. Is it okay if I use this blackboard? Is it visible? It's okay. It's okay for you, I'm sure. Yes. So in the approximately the first two lectures, my goal is to try to give some introduction to holographic duality with a minimum amount of overhead, with a minimum amount of background about string theory, and a minimum amount of stuff about supersymmetry. Now, an important subject and an important question for our discussion is exactly what the role of these ingredients are. Certainly, they've played an important role in the discovery of this duality, at least as it happened on this planet. And it's definitely a useful perspective. And so, with that in mind, the next thing we'll do is admit that indeed string theory exists and is useful, and we'll talk about what I guess should be called the decoupling argument, which is a derivation by subtraction of this ADS-CFT duality due to Malicena, starting from some particular solution of type 2b supergravity, which is something that I've been led to understand that you people know something about, if not the solution, at least something about type 2b string theory and maybe its low energy limit a little bit. Hopefully we can make this a not too unpleasant thing. And then after this, we'll develop some more technology, namely how does one actually go about computing some stuff using this duality. And then after that, we can get to some discussion of some applications of this business that people have tried to make. And I'll say a little bit about today about what those are. And I guess let me emphasize that this undertaking will be a lot more fun and a lot more useful if you people ask me questions and make comments and make rude remarks, and because I don't want to stand here talking to myself. It'll be that much better if we have some kind of dialogue. So I guess I should say, so I mentioned here that, I'm saying that there's going to be some kind of applications to physics, and so let me say a little bit at the beginning what kinds of applications I have in mind, and I guess before I do that, I should say what the basic statement of this is. So this thing that I'm introducing is some claim that certain field theories, certain relatively ordinary quantum systems with many degrees of freedom, can be solved in a pretty strong sense of the word solved using some auxiliary theory of gravity. And so what I mean by solved is that the two things are the same. There's an equality. Anything you can compute with one thing, you can compute with the other thing. And so this is a pretty remarkable thing, both from the point of view of, we're not very good at solving quantum field theories, and so it's nice if we have a solution of such a thing. And on the other hand, gravity is a pretty mysterious thing, so it's nice if we can describe a theory of gravity in terms of such an ordinary thing as a quantum field theory. And so this is a it's a pretty great thing, and we should understand it better. I guess one thing that should be said from the beginning is that when this quantum field theory is in a regime that's well described by this nice theory, this theory of gravity, where we can actually compute things, it's not the kind of quantum field theory that you read about in Peskin and Schroeder. And what I mean by that is it's not weakly coupled. It's not one where you can compute everything that happens just by computing a few Feynman diagrams. That is, the degrees, the excitations of the theory are not just some particles that are more or less free particles, which every once in a while decide to interact with someone else. It's a much more interesting thing. And the reason I say that this is obvious is that, well, when you read about such a quantum field theory in Peskin and Schroeder, there isn't some extra-dimensional theory of gravity popping out of this description. And so, you know, that would sort of immediately falsify my statement if I was claiming that it was true in that regime. And so part of our task is to understand in what regime the statement is true. Okay, and so having said that, and so the regime where it's true is when there's some strong coupling in the field theory, when the degrees of freedom are strongly coupled. And this is an opportunity because there are certain real physical systems which have a good right to be described by some strongly coupled quantum field theories, which otherwise we're basically stuck with. We don't really know what to do because the usual techniques that we have for studying such things aren't so useful. And so let me just say two words about this, just on this little corner of the blackboard. So there are certain systems for which usual techniques, and what I mean by usual techniques is the following. I want to say what I mean by that. Certain systems for which the usual techniques aren't so useful. And what I mean by usual techniques are perturbation theory, where you guess what the degrees of freedom are and suppose and you know, write down some theory where those degrees of freedom don't talk to each other, and then you add some little bit of interaction so that every once in a while they do something interesting, but where you can still figure out what it does. And this, you know, this requires having a good guess about what the right degrees of freedom are, which is something that sometimes is not available. And then the second technique is numerics, namely some kind of Monte Carlo or something like this. And this is also something that, despite lots of really clever and very diligent work, we're not really that good at yet, just because the systems that we're interested in have very many degrees of freedom. And so and in general, there's this thing called the sign problem, which makes this really hard. So these things don't always work. And so it's really nice to have some other tool to try to add to this very short list of things to do to try to study a quantum system. And so if you like, the goal of what we're doing is trying to add another thing to this list, which so far is it's not something that you can apply to, you know, given some Hamiltonian, here's the gravity dual, but rather it's, you know, that's the a kind of thing that we can hope to develop. So some examples of systems to which we might hope to apply this technology. So here, let me write this over here. So if you like, targets of interest that to which we might try to apply this technology that we're going to talk about are the Quark-Gluon plasma, which has been made at RIC, at the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider, and I think now at the LHC. Is this true? Have they made it? Or at least they're going to. I think they have. I think they have by now. I'm not going to say too much about this, but this is something to keep in mind as an example of some system which is experimentally observed to be strongly coupled. I could say a little more about that later on. The gravity dual has in fact already been useful for thinking about this. The second example is of a target of opportunity is called fermions at unitarity. Or maybe the whole thing should be in quotes, I don't know. No, they're really fermions. Fermions at unitarity, which is a certain strongly coupled non-relativistic quantum field theory, which can be realized using ultra-cold atoms. And a third example that I'll add to this list is non-Fermi liquid metals. So there is a large class of examples of non-Fermi liquid metals. This does not uniquely specify their physical behavior, but as you can see from the how bad a name this is, right? So we're specifying what they are by something they're not. They're not Fermi liquids. They could be, you know, gerbils. They can be anything. You can see that there's some information missing. There's some understanding missing about these kinds of things, and so these are some opportunities among many. And if I have the chance, I'll try to say something about these two. I think I'll definitely say something about this. I'll say something directed at this. Whether it's actually saying something about that is for you to decide. Okay, so I have one more prefatory kind of remark now, which is about this subject here, and then we'll get to the business. A word about string theory. Okay, so I've been led to understand that some or all of you have recently undergone some sort of training in string theory. Is this true? How many of you have taken the string theory course? All of you, is that? Yeah, no, almost all of you. Okay. Okay, good. This is good to know. Okay, so I will try to make the discussion here somewhat modular in the sense that a large fraction of it, I hope, will be intelligible to those of you who have not taken the string theory class. But like I said, the string theory does play an important role in this business, and so just let me say a few words about it. So string theory, it's a quantum gravity. Right. So this is what you need to know about string theory for what I'm going to say in the next two lectures. It's a quantum gravity, and that's I think we can all agree that that's a valuable thing in itself. But it's important to say that we don't really understand very well what string theory is. Rather, we have these various perturbative descriptions in certain situations, and we don't have the statement I just made is encoded. It's depicted in this picture where this is meant to describe certain limits. Where we have some perturbative description, and really we only know what happens at these corners, and in here is some big question mark. I guess it's important to say that an important goal in this business is to try to figure out what's in the middle of this picture. So this is, you know, the fact that there's this giant hole in the middle is a reason not to say too much about this. And there's another reason there's another important fact about string theory of which you should be aware, which is that, so I said here it's a quantum gravity. The indefinite article? But in particular, I'm implying by the use of this article that there's one of it. It's one theory. This is a conjecture, right? It's a conjecture that it's one theory described by this picture, with many ground states. This is a widely believed conjecture. The fact that it has many ground states, we shouldn't even talk about the alternative. So with many ground states, meaning that a picture of its configuration space, so this is a picture of, you know, an example of something that you need to specify, to specify a configuration of string theory, we think, is something like the geometry of space-time. So this axis here in my plot is the geometry of space-time. Obviously, that's not really a one-dimensional thing. This is a slice through some very large configuration space. This is meant to be a cartoon. And the vertical axis here is going to be something like a potential. And everything we know about this theory points to a picture like this, that there's some very complicated potential with, you know, him drawing some slice here, and which looks something like this. the power spectrum of this diagram does not carry any meaning. I guess it looks like there's some very large Fourier component here. Yeah, never mind. And there are each of these minima here, and maybe some of the maxima too. I should have drawn some AES maxima. Each of these minima represents some possible universe, in fact, with different laws of physics. And you know, actually, and some directions in the space actually are, the potential is flat, and so these are some of them. So I guess some of them have zero energy. I should have drawn some over here. Some of them go like this, something like that. And so you know, this type 2a here is somewhere over here. It has supersymmetry in 10 dimensions. It's a theory of nothing, in the sense that a supersymmetric vacuum is a very boring place. Some of these have negative vacuum energy. That's what this axis means. And so there's something like ADS vacua. And you know, they can have some number of dimensions. Maybe this one has 4 dimensions, and this one has 7 dimensions, and has positive vacuum energy. Maybe this is a de Sitter vacuum. And you know, some of them indeed look a lot like our world, that they have some small positive cosmological constant. Maybe they have some chiral gauge theory. You know, maybe it's something like the Standard Model. And so you know, there's some reason for optimism that a theory of our particle physics coupled to gravity is in there somewhere. Though I guess it should be noted that nobody has actually found it yet. We should keep looking. But you might wonder, and I think you could not be criticized for wondering, what the point of all these other vacua is. And part of the goal of the business that I'm describing here is to find a purpose to some of those other vacua. Namely, something that I will try to convey is that at least some of these, at least the ones that are down here, the ones that have negative cosmological constant, I don't know so much about these, but I should have drawn more of them down here. At least some of the ones that have negative vacuum energy actually describe some, by this holographic duality, some ordinary quantum systems, which in some of which may even be realizable in a terrestrial laboratory. Yes, please.
One of these minima, could we tunnel into a new one and kill us all?
Yeah, probably.
Good.
Yeah, and this from this picture, you can try to estimate the rate at which that happens. Yeah, this is a good exercise. So, I mean, I guess you might try to say something about the likelihood of this happening soon based on the fact that we've survived for 13 billion years already. But yeah, this is an interesting possibility. Was there another question? I thought there was another question. Did you? Oh, okay. All right. So this picture, I would say, is very loaded. It has a lot of both scientific and political baggage attached to it. But let's try to put that aside and try to think of it as a point of optimism, in that this landscape of vacua, at least some of them, mirrors the landscape of possible condensed matter phenomena. Whether this is anything like a one-to-one map is very far from clear. It mirrors something like a landscape of possible many-body systems. Okay, good. So I guess I should say an important open question in this area is exactly what the role of string theory for holographic duality is. There's some evidence which I think Pedro has been trying to convince you of, that string theory, at least perturbative string theory, has something to do with matrices. Yeah? Is this
an accurate characterization of what Pedro was telling you yesterday?
Now, on the other hand, if you give me some random quantum system, it's not necessarily the case that it can be organized as some matrix model, as something like where the degrees of freedom are matrices, where their interactions occur by matrix multiplication. And in fact, there are examples that we know about from string theory itself that are more general than this. So this is some subset of some possible things. And so it seems clear that this is a subset of possible things, and this is thinking about this duality is one of our few ways of making progress on this in this direction. Okay, so I think that was the end of my introduction. Are there any questions about the plan, about my sanity, about, yeah, anything? No? Okay. Ask more questions. I guess I have a question for you. How many of you prefer, having seen already the very high quality of my Blackboard work, how many of you prefer a Blackboard talk to slides? Okay, all right. That was pretty overwhelming. Good. So yeah, I'll continue to use the Blackboard. Yeah. Thank you for the vote of confidence. All right. And I'll try not to go below here on this one. Okay. So now I'm gonna really start from scratch, and start by making a very bold claim. Wait, I guess I already told you what the bold claim was. Following. The paper we're going to follow now is by Horowitz and Polchinski. Horowitz. Polchinski. It's from GRQC, which you all have taken some class in GR, at least the C part, right? So this is general relativity, quantum, and classical. So this is maybe a good... the intended audience of this article has a similar background to yours. Following this, I'm going to make some bold assertions, and then we'll try to develop some hints for what these assertions might mean. So bold assertion number A is. Some ordinary quantum many-body systems. Some ordinary quantum many-body systems. So you know, you look at the new CONMAT listings, pick a random paper, look at the Hamiltonian that they write down. Maybe that's one of these. Are actually secretly quantum theories of gravity. And I guess it's worth saying in extra dimensions. So what I mean by in extra dimensions is so an ordinary quantum many-body system lives in some number of dimensions, which is specified. So say d dimensions. And so by extra, I mean that the quantum theory of gravity, which this secretly is, lives in some number of dimensions, which is something bigger than d, maybe d plus 1, something like that. And so far, this statement maybe isn't so useful because, you know, I guess I already admitted over there that we don't really know what a quantum theory of gravity is. And I guess the definition that you should take for the purposes of this statement is a theory of gravity is one where the space or space-time on which the theory is defined is a dynamical variable. This is maybe a good working definition of what we mean by a theory of gravity. And quantum theory of gravity is one where it's a quantum theory. Yeah, okay. So that's a quantum system with dynamical metric. This is maybe too restrictive a definition of a quantum gravity, but I think it's a useful expedient. So far this isn't really this isn't a statement that you could use to solve some any interesting system because we need some handle on what this thing is. And so part B of the statement is very important, which is some are classical. So this is some subset of the set of ordinary quantum many-body systems, and some smaller subset of those are even classical theories of gravity. And a classical theory of gravity is something that we understand. There are certainly open questions about them, but we at least know what to do. The thing you do is you solve the Einstein's equations, basically, right? There may be some equations that are slightly different than Einstein's equations, but it's something like you solve the equations of motion for the metric, and so that's something we know how to do, and so this could be a useful and powerful statement. Okay. Okay, so we need to. So my job now is to try to figure out what these statements might possibly mean, right? These are crazy statements. We need to figure out what they mean, and to do that, I'm going to bring to bear three hints from three rather disparate areas of physics, which give us some insight about what's going on here. And okay, so the first one, hint number one is the following. So if there are enough space-time dimensions, if this D isn't something really like claustrophobic like one or two, then the statement that the metric is dynamical means that it has propagating degrees of freedom, right? In I guess above three dimensions, a spin two massless particle has propagating degrees of freedom, and okay, this is at least in D bigger than three space time dimensions. I don't really want to talk about smaller numbers of dimensions. Yeah. Then the statement that there's a dynamical metric means that there's some kind of massless spin two, propagating massless spin two excitation. And this is something which, how to say, when I say that I have a quantum many body system, that you would be surprised if I then inferred from that there was such an excitation. That's part of the surprise. And so, you know, the statement must mean that this is some composite excitation made of, you know, some collective mode of this many body system. It must be some emergent degree of freedom. And at least in some limited context, there's a theorem due to Weinberg and Witten from the early 80s, somewhere around there, which forbids this, which forbids the emergence of such massless spin two excitations. And the precise statement of the theorem is the following. It's that a quantum field theory, and here I really do mean quantum field theory in the ordinary sense, in that I mean relativistic quantum field theory. So with a Poincaré covariant, so I'm assuming Lorentz invariant, so that's a specification here, a Poincaré covariant stress tensor. So I'm assuming that there's some actual stress tensor of the theory, which, you know, in ordinary quantum theory, this is not a surprise. Forbids massless. Massless particles with spin bigger than one, that is including two, which interact, namely which have momentum. So by momentum I mean this particular charge made from the stress tensor, which is non-zero, which have non-zero momentum. So, you know, if you want to say that there's a graviton in the theory, it had better be able to carry momentum, and so that's forbidden by this theorem. You might ask, well, general relativity is supposed to be some theory of gravity, and which I can put in Minkowski space, and so there should be such an excitation, and so there's an important loophole here, which is exploited by GR. Does anybody want to tell me what the loophole is? So which of these ingredients is missing if I say quantize general relativity in Minkowski space perturbatively? So this theorem seems to say that it's not possible, right? That you can't possibly have a graviton in the spectrum, which, because that has spin two, it's massless and it carries momentum, there's gravity waves. It's a mystery, huh? So so both of the loopholes I'm going to mention are really pretty well hidden in you know, obvious assumptions. So the GR loophole is this symbol. It's that the stress tensor in the total stress tensor in GR is sort of by definition, the definition of the stress tensor is some proportional to the variation of the action with respect to the metric. right? This is what you mean by the stress. Maybe there's some square root of g in there somewhere. Maybe there's a minus and a 2. That depends on the signature. Something like that. Yeah? It's okay? Okay. And you know, in general relativity, this collection of symbols is something that appears in another context, namely when you find the equation of motion for the metric. Right? The vanishing of this is the Einstein equation. And so in a theory of gravity, at least in the usual way of constructing it, where we put in a metric as a dynamical degree of freedom, this thing is just zero. So it doesn't violate the theorem at all. So that's okay. Or if you'd like, the way we usually think about gravity is we take some ordinary system, like some matter, and then you couple it to gravity. The matter has a stress tensor. Right? So you might worry, well, why isn't there a stress tensor for the matter? But the stress tensor for the matter, T matter, is gauge invariant. And so it's not really there. And so there is no such stress tensor, and there's no puzzle. But there's another loophole, which is worth mentioning. So this is the holographic loophole. The holographic loophole is this. It's that the gravity can live elsewhere. So we have some ordinary quantum system. We're saying that there's some emergent theory of gravity, but the emergent theory of gravity is living in on a different space. It's living in some space with more dimensions. So that's the loophole that we'll take advantage of. And to get a hint as to who the extra dimensions are, should I try to write not so low on the blackboard? Would that be okay? I'll try to do that. All right. To get a hint as to the identity of these extra dimensions, here's hint number 2. Okay, that was hint number 1. There was some hint from, I guess, particle physics. Since it's Weinberg's theorem, we should call it particle physics. Hint number 2 is the statement that the RG is local in scale. Okay, so this is the statement of hint number 2, and I'm going to spend some amount of time explaining the meaning of these words, okay? Which I think many of the things I'll say, I'm sure, will be very familiar to some of you, but I think it's worth saying them anyway, because they're at least it'll give me some opportunity to introduce some language and some perspective on things that I'll be using for the remainder of our discussion. Yes.
Sorry, I still don't understand why living elsewhere should be considered as a loophole.
Well,
what is missing in our arguments?
Well, certainly in the proof of the Weinberg-Witten theorem, they were assuming that this massive spin to excitation was living in the same space as the so if you know if the statement that we're trying to make involves a graviton propagating in some other space, then this theorem has no bearing. So that's what I mean by loophole is that it's the reason that this theorem does not forbid the assertion I made. It's okay. All right, good. More questions? Ask questions, please. All right. So to explain this statement, I want to take a little bit of a detour and talk about an important concept called universality, which. How to say, it's worth talking about a lot here because it's definitely a crucial ingredient crucial ingredient in making holographic duality useful. So universality was first in the sense that I mean it here was first arose in as an experimental observation, namely that people studied. Various second-order phase transitions in various systems, like magnets and liquids, liquid gas transitions, and near such a second-order phase transition, the physical observables exhibit power loss,
right? So there's some control parameter, which maybe is something like the critical temperature, maybe it's the temperature, the critical temperature minus the temperature over Tc. So that's the definition of this parameter. And so just for example, a ferromagnet near the Curie point has some specific heat, which goes like this T, this parameter T to the minus alpha, where alpha is some parameter, some critical exponent, which, you know, which is the same no matter which magnet you use, which exactly, the independent of the microscopic details of the magnet. And the susceptibility, the magnetic susceptibility, goes like a power law with some other exponent. And then, so I said that this exponent is independent of the kind of magnet, but it's in fact much more robust than that. If you look at water near the liquid gas point, near the liquid gas critical point, it has a specific heat, which goes like T to the minus alpha, and some compressibility, which goes like T to the minus gamma. And this experimental observation of universality is that this alpha here is the same as this alpha here, and this gamma here is the same as this gamma here, even though obviously these things are very different systems microscopically. So same exponents, alpha, gamma, in systems which are very different microscopically. So this was an empirical observation, which begs some explanation, and that explanation comes from this renormalization group idea, which is a certain way of thinking about a system with many degrees of freedom, where we draw a picture as follows. So we imagine. So I'm going to describe this in a way which will be useful for our later purposes. So suppose we have some system which is the important thing is going to be that it's made from some local degrees of freedom, some degrees of freedom which are somehow distributed over space. I'm going to draw them on a lattice for purposes of illustration. So at each vertex of this square lattice, there's some degree of freedom. I don't know, some kind of little spin. There's a little arrow at every vertex. I should have drawn more of these guys here. Okay. So I'm gonna I'm gonna get tired of doing this, but you have to imagine that I did all of them. And the important information is two things. First of all, that the degrees of freedom are distributed in some extensive way, so that if we make the lattice bigger, we would add more degrees of freedom in a way proportional to the volume. And secondly, that the interactions between these degrees of freedom, which I can encode in some Hamiltonian, is local, that only things that are near each other interact with each other. So I could write the Hamiltonian as some sum of oversights, say I and J, I is some label, some multi-index labeling some position in the lattice, and J is some other such position. And this, by these little brackets, I mean that these site I and site J are nearest neighbors. So let's say this is I and this is J. So only the ones that are next to each other participate in this interaction. And then I, S is the spin, and Si interacts with Sj. And then there's some coupling constant, which let me call it J, J sub ij. And so this is some coupling constant. And then I could have some other interaction. Okay, I'm going to violate my rule here. Which again involves a spin at site I and some spin at site k, say, where now I and k are next nearest neighbors. So I'll write n, n, n for next nearest neighbors. And so, say this is I and this is k. And so they're a little bit farther away. And then there's some coupling constant here, which I'll call, big K or something, KIK. And so the important thing I want to emphasize two things about this. First of all, that the interactions are local here, right? Only things that are nearby interact. There's some range of the interactions, which isn't infinite. Or at least it falls off with distance. And these J's and K's you should think of as coordinates on the space of Hamiltonians. Okay? Yeah, so you know, you could imagine, so and then there's a whole bunch of other terms you could imagine writing here involving more spins, involving more sites. And so this Hamiltonian here, this specification of given some configuration of the S's, what energy does it have, is labeled by these coupling constants. It's these coupling constants label a point in the space of Hamiltonians. Okay, and so here we go. So with these ingredients, the RG idea, the renormalization group idea, is to introduce a coarse graining procedure, where we look at some block of spins, some collection of spins. I don't know. I've circled four of them here. Okay, well, let me just circle those, and construct a new system, which I'll draw over here. So here I have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Ah, oh, that's not a good number. Okay. Let's draw 8, and then here we'll draw 4. And these, okay, and again at each site there's going to be a spin, but the spin at this site is made by averaging these spins. And similarly, the spin at this site is made by averaging some spins over here, which I'll probably get the wrong ones, but something like this. Did I get it right? Maybe I got it right. And so again, we have some system of the same form, where again the Hamiltonian. So okay, where again the degrees of freedom are spins at sites of the lattice. The lattice spacing has doubled, if you like, if I group the spins this way, and I'd like the second step of the procedure is to define a new Hamiltonian in where I change the coupling constants in such a way that I get the same answers for all physical observables that I compute using these block spins. So here I had some Hamiltonian which was labeled by J and K, and after this step I get some new Hamiltonian, which maybe I'll call prime, maybe that's not a good notation, but some new Hamiltonian, which is designed to produce the same answers for long wavelength observables, but where the very short distance degrees of freedom, the very short wavelength excitations, are just missing from the description, and their effects have been averaged over. And so you see that this is something that you can keep doing, as you could probably tell from my organization of the picture. Eventually, it becomes hard to draw, but this is something you could keep doing. Which one is that? I don't know, maybe it's this one, right? And so you get some other Hamiltonian, and if you keep going, eventually you're forced to find out what happens at long wavelengths, which I guess it should be emphasized that these observables that are being observed here are long wavelength observables. So the output of this procedure, which it should be admitted is actually very hard to do in practice, and that's part of the reason why this technology that I'm going to talk about is so valuable. The output of this procedure is some flow on the space of Hamiltonians, which looks something like, you know, looks something like this. So here's these coordinates. Which one is this? This one is, maybe this one is J, maybe this one is K, and you know, so the starting Hamiltonian, which maybe, you know, maybe it was a model of a ferromagnet, is some starting point on the space of Hamiltonian. Maybe it's over here. So you know, maybe this is some lattice model of a ferromagnet. Is some starting point here, and this procedure produces some flow in the space of Hamiltonians, which I don't know, wanders around somehow. It has an arrow on it because you see you start at the short wavelength description and you go to longer and longer wavelengths. So you know, it's a one-directional procedure. And then the thing to think about is, well, what is it that happens eventually? Right? There's basically two possibilities. One is you run out of stuff, that you do this procedure, and after the next averaging, there's just no degrees of freedom left. That's sort of the boring possibility, which is called mass gap, which actually, I guess, is what happens to the ferromagnet away from the critical point. But then the other possibility, which is more interesting for our purposes, is that you could imagine a Hamiltonian where when you do this procedure to it, you get back the same Hamiltonian, right? In which case you would keep doing it and it would just go on forever. And such a point in the space of Hamiltonians would be a fixed point, of this procedure. That is, the flow in the space of Hamiltonians that we would define this way would stop there and just stay there forever. And so such thing is naturally called a fixed point. And so then the thing to realize is that a fixed point here, in general, has a basin of attraction in the space of Hamiltonians that you could start somewhere else and still end up here. And maybe, you know, the somewhere else where you started with is some lattice model of water, water molecules. And so, and I guess I should say that the starting point is always called the ultraviolet, or UV, and the ending point is always called the infrared, or IR. And many different UV starting points end up at the same IR starting point, and these critical exponents here are a property of the fixed point, and so this therefore this procedure explains this phenomenon. Yeah? At least in principle. Okay. So this gives me an opportunity to make a few more comments, and then I'll get back to the hint, which is here. Let's think about a situation where we're very near the fixed point, and so that is we've done this procedure many, many, many times, and so the degrees of freedom that are left over have wavelengths which are much longer than this microscopic lattice scale. And so we can basically ignore the lattice scale and treat the thing like a continuum theory, that is a quantum field theory. And so we can think about a Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian is a function of U. U is the parameter along this trajectory. At each scale U, we can expand this Hamiltonian. So there are d minus 1 spatial dimensions. We can expand this Hamiltonian as a sum of local operators. So this O is some local operator. It depends on where we are in the flow, and it depends on space. And then there's some Copley constant for each operator, which also depends on where we are in the flow. And to this sum over A is some very formal sum where, you know, for example, for a scalar field theory, with some microscopic field phi, what I mean by this list of O's is something like, well, phi is an O, maybe we don't want phi to be in the action. So, you know, d phi squared is an O, and phi squared, and phi to the 4. So all the operators consistent with the symmetries, we add together, and each of them has some coupling constant. And so at each step in the flow, we can expand the Hamiltonian this way. And so these, you know, if you like, these coupling constants are the coordinates in the space that I'm drawing here. And here comes the crucial point. Because this flow is defined by this iterative procedure, where to figure out what the Hamiltonian is here, we had to know what the Hamiltonian was at the previous step, right? We only need to know about just the very last step, the very immediately preceding step to figure out what happens. This means that these coupling constants satisfy an evolution equation of the following form. I could write it like u d du of this coupling constant. I said it has an upper index. So this d du is something like how much the coupling constant changes between here and here. I'm imagining, you know, that we've done very, very many of these steps, and so it's become like a continuous procedure. Is some function, which is called a beta function, some function associated with this coupling constant A. And the important thing is that it only depends on the coupling constants at that scale. It only depends on g of u, and importantly, not g of u prime, much, much less than u. You don't need to know what happened all the way in the UV, and you don't need to know what happened, what will happen, or you don't need to know what will happen all the way in the infrared to figure out what happens. And this is the statement. This is what I mean by the RG is local in scale, and this is a consequence of the locality and space of the interactions. And I guess I should mention, near a fixed point, by the way, this is a useful opportunity to introduce some notation. This beta function is determined by the scaling dimension of this associated operator. That is, OA of x u1 in general is related to what happens at some scale U2, some nearby scale, in this way, that there's some power law by which it rescales, and this set of possible powers that appears here, this power here is the scaling exponent of OA, and these scaling exponents are what determine these exponents here. It's worth mentioning that if you have terms in this Hamiltonian where the operators have very large scaling dimension, if this delta is some really big thing, big number, then you see as I scale towards the infrared, as U2 becomes larger and larger, I'm going to get confused about which way we're going. U large is the infrared. Then you see the did I get this wrong? I think I maybe want the U2 here. The correct conclusion from the correct equation is that operators with large scaling dimension have the property that you can just ignore them for large U. As you go towards the infrared, they become less and less important because this coefficient goes to zero. And such operators are called irrelevant. So in general, the criterion is, it's delta bigger than D is an irrelevant operator, irrelevant. So all of these operators that are drawn here are irrelevant in the sense in that the deviation from the fixed point goes away as you go towards the infrared. And the other possibility is an operator with small dimension, which would produce a flow near the fixed point, which goes away from the fixed point, something like this. So the operator whose coordinate, one second, is going in this direction is a relevant operator. This is the alternative. Yes, please.
Relevant operators that when you take quantum effects, you have the anomaly.
Well, what do you mean by classically? You're talking about some free field fixed point.
Yeah, or quantum dimension.
Well, I guess if that happens, then that means that the perturbation that you did in comparing those two statements, right? You started with some weakly coupled description, and then you did something to make it more correct. It was not a small one, and so you may, you may want to question its validity. But indeed, there is the special case of what happens if delta equals d, which is this marginal case where quantum effects have an opportunity to be very important. So notice, in this discussion here, I made no reference to perturbation theory, right? Of course, I also didn't calculate anything. So this is sort of a framework for thinking about what happened. And in practice, it's very hard to actually construct such a flow. And perturbation theory is one of the few tools. And then I guess there was a list of tools I had here, right? Perturbation theory is one of them, numerics is another one, and then I'm going to talk about a third one, which is actually a much more immediate tool for the case, in the cases when it applies. Okay, so that was hint number two, that, we started with this ordinary system living in some number of dimensions, which in this picture is two. And we produced this useful description of it, which involved this auxiliary extra dimension, whose coordinate I called u, and in this picture is going this way, where there's some redundancy in this description in that really each one of these layers of the system is describing the same physics, right? In fact, the one over here is describing less of the physics than over here because we've integrated out the short wavelength modes, but this is, it's a way that Ken Wilson and Kadenov have instructed us to package our understanding of the system, which is in practice a useful one. And I guess I should mention that more recently, so here I was talking about like a classical spin system. I wasn't really very explicit about that. But more recently, many people have been implementing this kind of real space RG in quantum many body systems, where drawing pictures like this becomes even more useful. And I guess one of the leading practitioners of this business is Jeffrey Vidal, who's I guess here now, and so they draw pictures like this, which can be argued to be the same pictures that I'm gonna
be drawing for the rest of the rest of this business. So okay, so that was hint number two, and now I'm going to move to yet a third field of physics to produce hint number three. Okay. Hint number three is the holographic principle. Which I guess I'm not doing a good job with references. I should cite a Tufte and Susskind there. The statement of the holographic principle is that in a system with gravity, in a gravitating system, the maximum entropy that you can put in a region with volume V, in a region V, V is the name of the region, not the volume, is proportional to the area. It's the area of the boundary of V. By this I mean the boundary of V in Planck units. And I guess I'm really making a slightly more specific statement in that, so there's some length scale here, which comes from the Newton constant, right? You take the Newton constant and then H bar and C, and you can make a length scale out of it. And I guess in saying that there's a Newton constant and not some more exotic constant describing the interactions of gravity, I guess I'm assuming that there's something like Einstein gravity. For more exotic theories of gravity, there's some similar statement, though. So let me stick with this. And so what I mean by the maximum entropy here is, so let me remind you, this S max, the maximum entropy of some system, is it's the log of the dimension of the Hilbert space, which in a system with, this is usually what we mean by the number of degrees of freedom, which in a system like one of these, here we had some spin system at each site, so that each site has like 2 degrees of freedom. It can be up or down. And so if I think of this as a quantum system, then the Hilbert space at each site has 2 dimensions. When I tensor together the Hilbert spaces at all of the sites, this is the number which goes like the number of sites times log 2, right? So for example, in a system with extensive, let's say, local degrees of freedom, like this one, this S max is something like n. I shouldn't call it n. Well, it's the volume over the lattice spacing to the number of dimensions, the number of fixed dimensions, times like log of 2 times the number of degrees of freedom per site. And so the important point that I'm making here, ignore all the other stuff, the important point that I'm making is that it goes like the volume, right? There's this factor of the volume of space here. And so this is different, right? This is a bold and shocking statement. Try to defend it. So to see that a gravitating system is different, I'm going to combine 2 facts. I kind of want to keep this picture. Let me erase this stuff, which was confusing. Okay, so let's combine 2 facts. So fact one. There's going to be 2 facts, and then we're going to add them, is that a black hole has entropy. This is a statement that you guys have seen, yeah? In order to have some consistent laws of thermodynamics, you have to assign some entropy to black holes, because otherwise you take your trash, you throw it in the black hole, it's gone, the entropy of the world decreased. You use it to power your spaceship, yeah? All right. This is, I think, a good argument. Exactly what the area is, what the entropy is requires a little further thought. And that further thought says that this is, at least in Einsteinian gravity, it's proportional to the area of the horizon times 4 times L Planck squared in Planck units. Oh, sorry, I guess I should. Let's call this G nu. Right, and so one check on the statement is that in d plus 1 dimensions, this this thing has units of length to the d minus 1, units of g Newton in d plus 1 spatial space-time dimensions is some length to the d minus 1, and this thing is a length to the d minus 1, so that's dimensional analysis survives yet again. Okay, and... And I guess a better way is to fix the coefficient, to make this an equal sign, we can appeal to the fact that black holes have a temperature, right? And this is something that we know from Hawking. So let me just remind you of why this is true. One way to think about why this is true: black holes have a temperature, which, for example, for black holes in 4D Minkowski space. In general relativity, is something like 8 pi g Newton, where there's an m here, and so we know how their energy depends on their mass, and so if we want to have some law of thermodynamics, some change in the energy had better be accompanied by some heat exchange, and so integrating this equation using the energy of the black hole is m in units of c squared. And the area of the black hole is 4 pi, 4 m squared, g Newton squared. Use this to integrate this equation, and you'll get that. And so really there's some total entropy, which is the entropy of the black hole plus the entropy of ordinary stuff. Okay, so this is, I guess, the generalized second law, which saves the universe from quacks. Even in the presence of black holes, it prevents perpetual motion machines. Okay, so this was fact one. And fact two is even easier. Fact two is that dense enough stuff collapses, turns into a black hole. That is, if you take a bunch of stuff and you just keep throwing stuff into some region, eventually, you'll throw enough stuff in and it'll turn into a black. It'll gravitationally collapse. It's the natural endpoint of the accumulation of stuff. And so now let's combine these facts. I guess we're running out of time, huh? Okay, we'll combine these facts and then we'll come back tomorrow. So combining these facts, 1 plus 2. Says that in a gravitating system, the maximum entropy in some region is the entropy of the biggest black hole in a sense. So by S sub BH, I mean the area of the biggest black hole that fits in your region divided by 4 g Newton. And here's why. Well, suppose that this weren't the case. Suppose that somebody gave you a configuration of ordinary stuff who's inside this region, which was not a black hole, but whose entropy was bigger than this entropy. Then you just throw your trash in, and your trash carries energy. If you throw enough trash in, eventually, using fact number two, it'll gravitationally collapse, and the thing will form a black hole. But the entropy of the black hole is this. Which by assumption is smaller than the entropy that we started with, and so if not, then we produce a situation where S initial is bigger than S final, which violates this generalized second law, and then you use this to power your spaceships, and all the quacks can do whatever they want, and you can't defend yourself against them. So the punchline of this discussion is that gravity in a theory with a gravity in how many dimensions do I want? I think I may have messed up my d's. Gravity in d plus 2 space dimensions has the same number of degrees of freedom as an ordinary theory in d plus 1 space in one fewer dimension. So that's the punchline. And so combining these facts, we're led to conjecture some statement like, something like gravity in a space with one extra dimension, whose coordinate is interpreted as the RG scale, should be equal to something like a quantum field theory, some ordinary quantum field theory in one fewer dimensions. And so our next task is to refine the statement. And the way we're going to do that is by focusing on a special case, namely the case where this map acts trivially, where we start at a fixed point of this procedure, in which case there's some extra symmetries that we can use to make some good guesses about what the correspondence should do. Okay, I think I should stop. Yeah, everybody's hungry? Okay, so let's stop for today. We'll come back tomorrow.